You're listening to Campus Review Radio.
Welcome to HeadX, hosted by Martin Betts. This podcast explores the changing landscape of the higher education sector. Welcome to the Higher Education Experience.
Welcome back to HeadX, everybody, and another exciting episode of the podcast where we interview a guest from overseas, joined by a great friend of mine as co-host in Paul Harper of the University of Queensland. Welcome, Paul.
G'day, Martin, and g'day to everyone.
And it's a conversation we're having at a very interesting time in the lifetime of the Accord, and a very interesting time in the future of higher education in Australia and around the globe, because you're joining me live from the lockup room waiting for budget papers to be released and the budget speech to be made, outlining the future of higher education. Is that right?
Yeah, it's really an exciting time for me. Last week, I got a call from Tony Cook, the Secretary of the Department, because I was part of the university's Accord Ministerial Reference Group. I had the opportunity to come down to Canberra to the Department of Education to get a briefing before the budget speech by the Treasurer, and then we're locked up until that speech in the Department of Education in Canberra. Sorry, there's a bit of background noise here with the people milling around talking about budget and what's going to be in it. We already know, as we'll talk about during this, there's a few the items we already know, including Saturday, where Jason Clare announced legislation enabling the minister to control international students, and how that's going to, we'll see how that'll impact on the budget, I suspect, tonight, as well as other things we can talk about.
Well, look, I don't suppose, being in the lockup, from my knowledge of what that process is like, you're going to be able to digest all of the pages, all of the words. You're great at counting pages and words, I know, and all of the information coming up. So I'm sure everyone will dissect that later. And you've told us about the most recent pre-announcements. But great that you could join us from there. Look forward to hearing your considered views on the budget alongside everybody else's. And look forward to us taking that perspective that you now have to today's guests on the podcast.
Fantastic. And it's great to be with you again, Martin, and with your listeners. And I'm really honoured by the opportunity to once again participate in the podcast.
Well, we're always really pleased to have you on. You're a great advocate for inclusion in our sector, for addressing the issues of disabilities in higher education and its staff and students, and putting policy in place to overcome that. And you're a great advocate for equity, which of course has been such a theme with this podcast, with our events, and with all of the thinking in the sector through the Accord.
Yeah, I think the indexing of help, and that which will open opportunities, particularly to reducing the debt. And we've got to realise, if you reduce the debt of students now and also existing students, that opens up opportunities for them to do other things with that money, like buying a house, investing in the economy, starting a small business. So I think it's a really important, and particularly last year with the ridiculously high consumer price index, the fact that they're waiving that or down to 3%, yeah, I think it's really really impactful. The item around providing support for students on placement to help reduce placement poverty is really an important step. If you look at the Accord, it picked three areas, which the minister responded to those three areas. And I think from what he was saying, there's going to be consideration further. So it's a top-up. Some people call it a payment, but it's really a top-up of what their existing payments they already have. So I think it's really important to help reduce that poverty and open up more opportunities for people from people who don't have rich parents, don't have shares, or have existing resources to finish degrees in nursing, social work, and teaching. And let's face it, we need more teachers, more social workers with the mental health crisis, and nurses have really been under strain with COVID.
I certainly have. And look, those steps are really important and very, very appropriate for you to comment on them with all the work that you do in inclusion in Australia. And they're not unconnected with this week's guest, Paul. And look, we've got a very exciting guest from my point of view, and I know it will be someone that you're excited about too. Our guest is Deborah Johnston. She's the Deputy Vice Chancellor of the Academic Framework at London South Bank University, a university with a very particular social mission and focus on equity students. But she's also, like you, someone recognised in the National Honours System. She got an MBE in the 2024 New Year's Honours List in the UK. And as well as that, she leads national disability advocacy, as you do. And in her case, is very involved in the British Stammering Association. What do you think of the parallels between her journey and yours before we go to an interview, Paul?
Well, as a leader in higher education with a disability myself, you know, I use a guide dog and I'm totally blind. So it's really uncommon to find senior leaders, like deputy vice chancellors in particular, or vice chancellors, who have a disability or a medical condition, and even more rare for those leaders to be open about what their experiences are. So when people like in those positions are open, then they use their diversity as a means of opening up opportunities for others. And that's what Deborah has been doing. I think it's really powerful, and it inspires people who are the next step down to see what can be done when you step up and speak out on issues that impacted upon you and impact upon others in the community.
Well, that's a lovely commentary from you on the guest that we're about to hear from. And we'll come back and dissect some of the things that Deborah shares with us, Paul, straight after this message from our sponsors.
Short on resources to enhance your university's online learning objectives? OES's collaborative approach ensures program success while offering flexibility across disciplines. Our tailored solutions uphold academic rigour and your reputation. Choose OES for adaptable, high-quality online learning experiences.
My guest today on HEDX is Professor Deborah Johnston, who's the Deputy Vice-Chancellor Academic Framework with overall responsibility for education at London South Bank University. She joined LSBU in April 2020, coming from a similar position where she currently previously worked at SOAS in the University of London, and she'd held that position for over 4 years. Deborah's an economist, and she completed an undergraduate degree in economics and an MPhil in the Economics and Politics of Development at Queen's College, Cambridge. And she then completed a PhD in economics in 1997 at SOAS in the University of London. She split her career across academia, charities and government, which might populate and influence some of the things that she says later on in this interview. But her academic work has focused on inequality and poverty. And she's a passionate advocate for the power of education to change people's opportunities in life. What a great attitude to have and a great thing to bring into this interview. She's a person who stammers and has worked closely with both the British Stammering Association and the Stammering Through University campaign to ensure greater awareness of the needs of students who stammer. Her work at SOAS also involved a close partnership with the Students' Union to eliminate the racial awarding gap. In both LSBU and SOAS, she is the institutional champion supporting access and success for all students. What a great bio. And Deborah, a warm welcome to the HEDX podcast.
Thank you, Martin.
And Deborah, you've as that intro and that bio illustrates, you've really achieved national recognition for your services to education, and you now lead education at London South Bank University. It's a place I know well from a long time ago, in one of the most distinctive higher education institutions in the UK, in its national capital, with a particular setting, I might say. But this position for you has come after an education of your own in one of the world's oldest and most famous universities, having overcome significant personal challenges and disability of your own along the way. I wonder, how would you describe briefly, I'm sure there's a long story there and I'm sure there's lots of different nuances to it, but how would you summarise your journey from whatever your beginnings were in life to overcoming challenges along the way to be where you got to along that journey and where you are now today? What's your story?
Yeah, well, you know, I used to think I was really unusual, Martin. By the way, I'm going to say, because I'm a person who stammers, I'll get stuck on words in this. And I want to say to you and to our listeners, you know, that's perfectly fine. It will be perfectly okay. Yeah. And so, yeah, so I used to think I was really unusual. And what I've realised is I'm completely typical of the kind of senior leader within university. So it was challenging. I'm from a dual heritage background, we'd call it today. So my dad was Pakistani. My mum was Irish. Growing up in Hounslow in West London, particularly in the 1970s, it was tough. And, you know, it was tough. And bad things happened. You know, some of those experiences were really negative. I think that sort of combined with having a stammer, you know, which was far more noticeable, you know, didn't always have great support in school around that, you know, with a couple of, you know, difficult teachers. For me, you know, education was the thing I put my effort into because it was great to succeed. It was a beautiful space that I could feel positive about myself. I could get that sense of self-esteem. And it was a space where whatever else was happening, you know, I could have that positive feedback. And I think that sort of combined with, you know, that it opened doors. So, you know, first in my family, my mum was a cleaner. She worked for Marks and Spencers. My dad was, he started off as a baggage handler in Heathrow Airport and then, you know, opened a corner shop. And he and my mum split up when I was about 10, and we went to live in a council estate in Hounslow, the beautifully named Midsummer Avenue estate. Fabulous name, yeah. And again, I think that was what, you know, got me focused on education, and because it was that place to get self-esteem. It was that place that was separate from day-to-day life. And it was that place where, you know, you could take yourself out of the way you were valued and seen elsewhere and be valued in a different way. And do you know what I've realised? I think that is so typical of so many of us in higher education. You've got to have that love for it. You've got to believe it is transformative. You've got to have had that personal experience. And I used to think it was really unusual, my background. And I began to realise how typical it is. So definitely that sort of story of seeing education as the way to a better life. But I've got to say, and I'm going to, so this isn't as short as you'd want, Martin, but it wasn't just that individual journey. It was definitely great teachers, great lecturers in university. And, you know, the sort of structural conditions when I was studying. So I did my undergraduate degree in Cambridge. Very much, I think, affirmative action by Queen's College. Fantastic for them because I went to a comprehensive. But, you know, with a full grant and my fees paid for.
Mm.
And then when I did my MPhil, I couldn't get a maintenance grant. That was 1988. Cambridge had lost its status to get a maintenance grant, and I had to work. And of course, what I did was I worked in a supermarket in the middle of Cambridge. You weren't meant to. I broke the rules, yeah. And one of my lecturers went in and saw me because, you know, I'd always worked in supermarkets as a teenager, so I was just doing it in Cambridge, you know, that was a natural thing. And he got me a job instead in the Land Economy Library, much better paid. And that's what really helped me succeed in that MPhil. And if he hadn't done that, I don't know if I would have really managed to keep paying the bills. So, you know, I've got to say, not just my own individual story, but very much about, you know, luck and the right people around me at the right time.
What a gorgeous story, Deborah. Thank you so much for being so open and sharing that with us. And a council estate from... a council estate in Hounslow to Cambridge University is quite a leap, isn't it? And having some familiarity with the universities that you've worked at and their settings, particularly the contrast between South Bank University and Cambridge, I know less about SOAS, but I'm sure you can fill me in on the gaps. They must be very different in their settings and must be very different in their culture. And I wonder how you would describe the contrast in opportunity that they're providing to learners. You've been a beneficiary of Cambridge and SOAS and are now working at South Bank. But what is the contrast in opportunity that they're able to provide and the mission that they each serve? What would you summarise that to be?
So I think that's a really good question. And I think, you know, I was thinking about it made me think of, you know, that debate between what's the difference between a degree from Oxford and a degree from Oxford Brookes. I don't know if you can remember back, there was a debate we had back in the UK some like a decade ago. So I think for me, it's that intangible thing, isn't it? And it's that piece about what gets valued or what you feel gets valued and what's the story that an institution tells about itself. And Cambridge was, I mean, Cambridge was amazing. It was challenging. And honestly, I had imposter syndrome all the way through that and actually for, you know, ages afterwards. But it was beautifully resourced, amazing facilities, amazing lectures, amazing libraries, yeah, all of that. And I think that there is, you know, very much a story about thinking about thinking, yeah, like, you know, really that really honing your skills about how you think about, you know, academia, what you think about, you know, what's a theory, how's it constructed. And personally, I think that's the value that it brings. It's that deep thinking about, you know, what is it that we value within a university? You know, what is the, how is knowledge created? How's it applied? And certainly that's what I got from it. But yeah, but challenging from someone from my background. So I absolutely spoke to my background. So of course, you know, so for people that don't know it, it's a very it is very much a global university. All of the subjects there are applied with a global lens. Very diverse staff body, very diverse student body, and that really spoke to both, you know, my own experience. But given that by the time I did my PhD, I'd been working internationally as well, and I think it's about reframing what are the subjects that we teach, how, you know, what's the reach of those subjects? So are our subjects relevant in today's globalized world? And I think there's a really important reframing that SOAS does there. And that spoke to me. And actually, this is not an issue about the joy of diversity, which SOAS, you know, has that joy, absolutely. Yeah. This is also an issue about actually, you know, how relevant are our universities? In a world in which, you know, populations are booming in the global south, you know, how relevant will British universities, Western universities be, and how do they keep that? And SOAS is absolutely in that space. And that was, you know, I found that really positive, really thought provoking. LSBU, of course, speaks to the economist in me, and you know, because it's focused on professional and technical education, and you know, it's all about raising productivity, raising skills, you know, improving that opportunity for people through skilled employment. So you know, it's a story about social mobility through skilled employment through a wider range of career options. And you know, that's my personal story, but you know, speaks to me in terms of my discipline as well.
Yeah, well, look, you've brought us on that lovely journey through three quite different places at different stages of your life to where you are now at South Bank University, London South Bank University. You're there as the Deputy Vice Chancellor of the Academic Framework, very grand title. I wonder what it means and what responsibilities you have in that role and what goals that you set for yourself and probably others set for you in executing it and how you measure the primary challenges of doing that role, whatever it is, at South Bank University at this current time.
So there are two ways I could answer this question, Martin. One would be to bore your listeners, absolutely bore them solid. I could read out, you know, all of the aims of that academic framework area, but I think you can summarize it. And it is that, so if I look at the sort of range of different teams, amazing people that I work with, it is very much about, you know, are we doing things right? And are we doing the right thing? So, you know, particularly, you know, academic quality sits under me, the, you know, sort of piece around portfolio development, assurance and governance. And that's, you know, the central questions for any university. So I love it because it is very much about, you know, that focus. Have we got the right approach? You know, are we doing the right thing? So that's my easy answer, my less boring answer to that question. And again, really, it's really, really easy to say, you know, what are the outcomes? Because they are those, you know, big things that we all care about. Are student outcomes improving? Is student satisfaction improving? Is is the university achieving what it's setting out to achieve? So, you know, we've got a range of goals around graduate employment, as you might expect, around the sorts of qualifications that we've developed. And particularly because LSBU is a group, and I don't know if your listeners will know this, but we have an academy, we have a sixth form, we've got two colleges as part of the group. So, for example, we've got a goal about the progression across the group. Are we giving new opportunities for learners in our area to actually have, to study in different ways? And is that successful?
Gosh, it was when I came back to visit you recently in London at Borough Roads and revisited a place that I'd known so well. I did my PhD in a predecessor institution of London South Bank University. It was originally the Brixton School of Building, and by then, when I was studying there, it was South Bank Polytechnic. And it was so nice to go back, but it was also so lovely to talk to you then and to hear you again now describe LSBU as having been given a new opportunity to progress as a university since those times, and the expectations its stakeholders, both local and further afield, must have. What would you summarise as the opportunity that you think LSBU has now that is different from what it was in its predecessor institution days?
You know what? I think I'll turn it on its head to say I think it's always so if you look back at LSBU, it's always taken those opportunities. It was innovative to start off with. So, I'm not sure how many people know the origin story of LSBU, but I think we're sort of talking about the sort of, late 1900s, the 1880s, founded by subscription. But, those were subscriptions from employers, from, workers, from the people in South London. Completely innovative and unusual for that time. Setting up a range of technical schools, boys and girls, setting up the National School of Bakery, which is amazing. It's been around for like more than 100 years. And then, of course, if we move forward, you've talked about the inclusion of Brixton School of Building. LSBU included a whole range of other technical institutes during that time. So it's always been at that innovative space, I'd say. And then you're right, it got university title in 1992, in the UK we call it a post 1992 institution, and then it didn't get fixed in stone then. So in about 2015, I think it was started looking at setting up an academy. So we established a South Bank Academy. We started at a university technical college that then became South Bank sixth form, and then I think in about 2019 we became the LSBU group with both an adult gateway college and South Bank Technical College. So always been innovative, hasn't stopped, and sort of we'll keep going. We'll always be looking for those spaces where we can do something different.
I remember when we were chatting in your office together, you were describing to me some of the challenges of the multiple regulatory bodies and we were reflecting on how so many places like to aspire to be innovative, but often regulations can constrain that. And I was fascinated that since we met, your Vice Chancellor, David Phoenix, wrote a blog for the Higher Education Policy Institute in the UK, commenting on the extent of regulation in the UK higher education systems and the barriers that does present to innovation by all of the constituent institutions, not just LSBU. You're describing an institution that has an inherent history and mission to be more innovative than many. Do you believe it would have been able to achieve even more in recent times and even over an extended period if the regulations weren't so constraining?
So absolutely, and that's what David Phoenix, as you said, he wrote that blog very recently, and the point he's trying to make there is you think about regulatory burden. So we're particularly looking at the space around apprenticeship standards, New technical qualifications here in the UK. We've got this new set of qualifications called Higher Technical Qualifications, HTQs. And, you know, we're working to four different regulators in this space. And that, you know, puts a huge burden on us. And it also means that it takes a long time. You can't be quick, you can't be nimble. So it, yeah, the quick answer to your question is yes. If that was more streamlined, yeah, you know, if that was a better process, then you know, we could be better, because you think about what we're doing, you know, working with employers, looking at where we can provide a qualification that meets employers' needs, that will be good for our learners, that fits with their education journey. That's something that you want to be more responsive on, and that's. That is hard right now.
Certainly is, and I've reflected on my recent tour around UK, US, and Australia that the difference in regulatory environment in different systems is quite a differentiator in how institutions in all those places can achieve. I come on to another outcome in the HEPI blogs that I've been observing from a distance that. Contrast not so much regulation, but offer an alternative to some of the standard university rankings. Regular readers of this podcast will know I've really got it in for the rankings. I think they are major barriers to innovation, to differentiation, to integrity in how we present ourselves to potential students, actually. But your institution has worked closely with HEPI on developing something called a social mobility index as an alternative to standard commercial rankings and how they measure our universities. Why did London South Bank University initiate that index? What's it about? And what do you think its value is in measuring the contribution of a university?
So it was absolutely, you know, it was absolutely about that frustration. I think you just talked about it. You know, the frustration that the indexes, you know, they don't really tell us what our contribution is, particularly in terms of providing opportunities. You know, that sort of distance travelled for people. So that work was done. We had a new corporate strategy. We were developing it. And at that point, it's saying, actually, you know, what are we going to use as external benchmarks? And absolutely, as you said, we kept thinking, well, if we put in elements on the league table, right, you know, that's going to be something that will just disguise some of the really important things that we want to do. And it was this piece to say, is there a better way to show what universities do in terms of giving people options? And, you know, can we use the existing data and combine it in different ways to show the number of people that are coming from disadvantaged backgrounds and the distance that they travel? And that's exactly what that was trying to do. And so, and it was born out of frustration. I think what was really good and surprising is that a lot of people have very much appreciated it. And we were only going to do it on that one occasion. And because of that real interest, we have continued to keep it updated.
Very good. And it has a quite different ordering of institutions and the contribution that they're making than those that we typically see in ranking systems, doesn't it? And your own university does much better in that than it does in conventional rankings of how many Nobel Prize winners you had amongst your alumni. I'm sorry I haven't got one yet to help the cause along, but
it's still time.
Thanks, Deborah. It's a quite different way of measuring the contribution of a university, isn't it?
It is, but it's also true. You know, so what that shows, so anyone that wants to look at it, please go, you know, you'll find it on the HEPI website. So there are some of those, if you like, sort of high tariff institutions there as well. So you'll see King's, LSE and UCL. And they come in there because although they have much smaller shares of disadvantaged students, they do deliver really significant social mobility for those students. So I think what that index does is I think it does apply to universities with really different missions. I think it does help you sort of see, you know, through your mission, what's the impact that you're having. But you're absolutely right. It also is a challenge because there are a number of, you know, top top tariff institutions that don't do well in that index, and a number of others that do extremely well. And it's about that piece of what's the impact that they're having in terms of creating new opportunities for disadvantaged learners. And there are different ways of doing that.
There are, and disadvantaged learners can be served in different ways by different institutions. And all learners have got different things that they need to be served would be an observation I'd make. And the global priorities for universities and higher education could be argued to be progressing from, you know, maybe a focus a little bit more on knowledge development and for graduates to be more about skills enhancement. It almost sounded like what you were describing, South Bank as an institute was set up for 120 years ago. But that developing skills and their enhancement for lifelong learners, if that is an evolution in mission for many institutions, how does a place like London South Bank University in 2024 stand to make a contribution to that mission now compared with, you know, I can't help thinking back to SOAS and Cambridge University. Is your time in the sun coming, do you think?
If we look at what LSBU does, what we've always done, it is very much in line with, you know, the skills agenda, you know, this focus, I think, on the working population as a whole. As you said, I think a lot of universities are sort of thinking through what that means for them. I think we'll all have seen those figures, and they are pretty depressing figures if you're only looking at 18-year-olds. But those figures of, you know, global population growth over the next couple of decades, and possibly we're in for a positive sunny patch for the next, you know, 20, 30 years. But it begins to get tough, and it begins to get tough because everywhere those, you know, young populations are falling as a share. You know, the world population is generally getting older. And I think that combined with, you know, everything we know about the fourth industrial revolution, that continued need to really distinguish yourself through, you know, skills acquisitions, I think universities are going to have to change their mission. They're all going to respond to it in different ways. I mean, you've asked a question about SOAS and Cambridge. They'll probably be thinking about different ways to bring people in, and to bring people back, and, you know, to bring people back to university after they've, you know, done a standard undergraduate degree. I guess at LSBU, what, you know, we'd like to challenge universities with is that there are so many other pathways. You know, there is the sub-degree qualifications that we, I mean, I hate that phrase because there's something sort of inherently judgmental about it. But, you know, all those other sorts of qualifications and ways of learning that, you know, are about level four and level five qualifications, and short courses, modular courses. I mean, that's, you know, that's where the future is going to be, and we'll all respond to it differently. But yeah, I'd say LSBU is definitely very well placed to do that because it's something that we're already doing.
Well, one observation that I'd make from a recent interview that I had with someone from another institution, one of your peers, was his Anthony Finkelstein, the Vice Chancellor of City University of London. And I interviewed him a few weeks ago in the middle of the same trip where you and I met, actually. And he told me about his own thoughts around digital disruption, its impact on universities, their need to change, and also described the merger that they have in play. Can't believe that you've let someone north of the river pinch St. George's University Tooting off of your home patch, Deborah. But there you go. That ship has probably sailed. There's a merger taking place. Have you got too many universities in the UK and in London?
So just within London, there are more than 60 higher education providers. I think its claim to fame now is that we probably have the highest density of universities of anywhere in the world. I guess the question is, you know, is it too many? Well, what does it bring? And I think if it's bringing more choice for learners, and, you know, London is a destination. I think it's been voted as, you know, the best university city several times in a row, depending on what survey you look at. You know, if it's building more choice, and certainly that's the space that London South Bank University is in, then that's a good thing. I think, but you're right to ask the question, will we still have the same number of universities in 5 or 10 years' time? And I think, you know, that's only going to be the case if those different providers can make themselves different, can make themselves distinctive. And if they can't, we will see mergers.
So you're not about to reveal a scoop for me here that you're about to merge with Imperial College or something next week?
I'm sure they would love to have us, Martin. I'm sure they would. But yeah, we've already done our merger with our two technical colleges, our academy and our sixth form. I think we're letting that really bed in at the moment. So, you know, it's watch this space. What's interesting are the number of universities following the path that we followed, you know, looking at those really close links with, particularly with further education colleges. Mm. And that's, so when we look at mergers, we shouldn't just think of universities merging with other universities. I think there's obviously there are really interesting areas that are about, you know, other kinds of education institutions merging, because that's where you're going to get some of that really innovative provision. And that's also where you're going to get that greatest choice and scope for, you know, people that want to engage in more study.
It's fascinating. We've got a major bit of policy review going on in Australia at the moment, with one of its key goals and features being closer integration across the vocational education and training sector into higher education and the university sector. And that we have a number of dual sector institutions in Australia already, but you seem to be making an argument that we might see even more of that on a global scale as we move more towards the skills agenda along the LSBU model. Is that what you think might happen?
Yeah, I do. Because if we think about, so there are two reasons for that. Firstly, if we look at, you know, where are the bulk of young people learning? And, you know, the bulk of young people are learning in further education colleges, the bulk of people in the UK, not in sixth forms, you know, not in schools. And so, you know, I think it's about, you know, going to where people are. And we also know that there are different pedagogic approaches. You know, there are different environments within those. You know, if we think about our technical college, it is a really applied environment. And if you're someone that, you know, wants to absolutely, you know, get that classroom instruction, get that technical instruction, but do it in a way that, you know, you're developing those skills at the same time, then that kind of environment might be the one that's best for you. Also might be the kind of environment that's best for that qualification that you're studying. So absolutely it makes sense, and I think it is the way that we should be, you know, that things will go in the future. Because if we're talking about people returning to learn and they're in, you know, they're either retraining or they're enhancing their existing skills, who's to say that that is always going to be a kind of classroom-based university-type experience? It's going to happen in various ways. And, you know, having a broader way to deliver that is going to be, it's going to mean you can give different options about ways of studying.
Yeah, that's a very interesting way of reflecting upon it from the very obvious experience that you've had in your role now at LSBU from those predecessor places that you studied at and have worked at. And look, going back to some of the things that we said at the start of this interview, Deborah, you've obviously had personal experience as a learner in overcoming and recognising disability. I'd like to go back to the disability topic again, if we might, and ensuring that equity of opportunity to access and completion of study by all groups in society is prioritised. And your council estate, Hounslow origins combined with a disability. I wonder what your observations would be about the way that different types of universities, and maybe universities in comparison with other sorts of employers, prioritise that giving opportunity to all, and how that's changing.
Yeah, and it's it's the key question. And I think we cannot ever turn the clock back on this moment when we're looking for universities to actually benefit the bulk of society. But when we look at how different universities do it, I mean, there are really different stories. So, you know, a really good example is, you know, focus on care experience students. And there have been some fantastic pieces of work done looking at how care experienced students in the UK can be supported to have great outcomes. And you've got some universities that, for example, give a bursary of, you know, £2,000 per care experienced student to help them succeed. And that's fantastic, right? That is really fantastic. It's been shown to have a really strong impact. It keeps those students in the university, helps them finish, helps them get fantastic degrees at the end. The challenge there is that the kinds of universities that are generally engaging in that are the ones that have got very few care experienced students, you know, and so that's the kind of initiative they can engage in. Again, they're taking a few students and actually helping them travel a really great distance, and that's fantastic. I think what the, you know, questions are is, you know, what happens in other universities like LSBU? We've got, you know, double the average of, you know, care experienced students. How do we engage in that unless there's a clear national program? And so so, you know, the question about, you know, how do individual universities do, I think, just as we spoke about before, you see different trajectories. So you see some universities with the bulk of their students being students that would have traditionally not been in university, traditionally, not have experienced or not have had a positive experience. And they are doing amazing jobs at turning that round and actually looking at what works for those students and giving them an environment where they can excel. And so that's fantastic. And you see that within the sector. I'm sure you have that in every country. Then you've got other universities where those, you know, that's a small percentage that of students that might fall into that category. And perhaps they do that by, you know, perhaps not by changing their whole system of delivery, but they'll do that by supporting those students with in sort of smaller, more focused ways. And I guess the challenge is that, you know, if we really want our university sectors to be successful for everybody, not just for a few, but for everybody, it is about, you know, measuring them in a way that helps you see that. So we talked about it, about, you know, indices, actually doing a proper job of that, you know, really helping you understand what your university mission is. But also thinking about what's the context. So what is the national funding? And if you're only looking at universities trying to find the funding to do that work, what you're going to see is what I've just talked about, which is, you know, the few with deep pockets and small numbers will be able to throw resources at it. Others will be trying to find ways to make their whole university more inclusive. And that is challenging in a moment when, you know, resources are tight.
Well, you've put your finger right on the button there, haven't you? I mean, but just explaining by way of contrast some of the settings that I'm more familiar with, where I live in Australia, with what you're describing, we in our policy review are looking to grow our numbers significantly by targeting more students to come into the system from equity groups, and also recognising that there are extra costs associated with supporting to succeed students from those groups, and looking to find some ways of differentially resourcing the support of students that need more resources. Mm-hmm. That's in contrast to, I can't believe what's going on in the UK, Deborah. I'm sure you can believe it even less well, but you've had fees per student, your funding per student for all of your universities set at whatever the number is, 9,000 and something pounds, since, I think it's since 2017, is that right?
No, well, actually, it goes back even further. 2017, we had a small increase that was the £250 increase, you know. So, you know, fees have been set for a long time, and the real value is, you know, hovering less than £6,000 now, you know, compared to that original £9,000 fee.
You told me when we met in London that there'd been a Universities UK, I think it was Universities UK or some other major sector conference in the UK, where the most oversubscribed and best attended parallel session or session in the conference was the one with a lawyer giving advice of how to manage insolvency in a British university. Is that right?
Surreal. surreal moment. You know, a room full of university leaders scribbling away, taking notes on the university insolvency process.
Gosh, it's a different way of thinking about the future than what most of us would want to be doing. And given what we just said there about a difference in the proportion of equity students, and if the Australian assumption is right that we need more funding and more resources for students that are needing more support to succeed. The great level of vulnerability in British universities right now, UK universities right now, where does a place that's trying to fulfill a mission like LSBU stand on that level of vulnerability? I'm sure it must be much more vulnerable than Cambridge right now.
Absolutely true. We don't have the deep pockets that, you know, some universities do. It's also true that we've got some advantages. We've got that more diverse student body, so we're not as tied to any particular student group as, you know, some other universities are, because we have a really wide set of people that study with us, and we have a, you know, much wider set of qualifications. So it's absolutely swings and roundabouts, Martin. Things that make us vulnerable, things that give us strength. And yeah, we'll be absolutely trying to chart that course, trying to keep us in a, you know, good position. But, you know, I've got to say, it isn't just, you know, we've sort of talked about that challenging environment. Exactly right. Exactly right. But I think universities have got to step up to it. I mean, you know, that last question, I was just thinking back that, you know, what I think I should have said as well is, yeah, there is a challenge, but, you know, universities have got to make themselves accountable. So one of the things I lead in the UK is the Disabled Student Commitment, and I chair the national group to support the uptake of that. And that's a series of principles that, if put into place, would, you know, really transform the environment for disabled students. And what I'd say is, however tight the funds are, you know, you've got to listen to your students. And the Disabled Student Commitment is all about working in partnership with students, hearing the disabled student voice. And we could say that for any group of students. And so I, you know, when times are tough, right, when your finances are tight, that's when you've got to be even more sure that you're spending those, you know, those precious funds in the way that is the most impactful. And that is when you've got to hold yourself accountable. You've got to talk to your students. You've got to listen to what they say. So absolutely, the environment is tough. But, you know, we shouldn't use this as a moment to step away. And to sort of actually, we've got to step forward, and we've got to be even more accountable. We've got to listen even more.
That's a very compelling case being made for not being in denial and accepting the need for change. One of the things that I noted, particularly from my recent visit to the UK and contrasting it with a Universities Australia conference that I attended before setting off on a trip, and what I sense all of the anticipation is around the ongoing development and review of policy here, is a much greater acceptance of change and the need to change and to find new ways of doing things amongst UK university leaders and chancelleries than I'm finding in other parts of the world. Do you actually think that that might be putting you at some point of advantage? It might not feel like it much of the time.
I'd like to think that. I mean, and that would be a lovely piece of optimism and sort of, you know, light on the hill, wouldn't it? I would love to think that. And I think certainly, you know what, there won't be a university in the UK that hasn't had to think really carefully, you know, what are we about and why are we doing what we're doing? And that's got to be a good starting point. So, yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. Times have been tough. They've been tough for some time. But it, you know, perhaps that has put us in a good position. Perhaps it's, you know, it's got every university to really think, you know, what, you know, what's our mission, and, you know, what is it we should be doing. And yeah, I very much hope that helps us as we go forward.
Well, it's always good to end something like this on an optimistic note, isn't it? So just in bringing all of this to a close then, Deborah, it's been fascinating talking to you. Well, but what does get you jumping out of bed in the morning with a sense of purpose and optimism at the moment about how you personally and how your institution can make a difference every day, despite the toughness of the circumstances? And what is the essence of your message of hope for everyone in the sector right now, of what can be done to achieve genuinely equitable transformation for all in our society from our universities?
I think the answer will be the same for anyone that you speak to. And I think it is that sort of, you know, that tangible knowledge, the fact that, you know, we will each know that our university is doing an amazing thing. And that's what I think every day. You know, we've got great things that we're doing. I can see that we've brought in new interventions. Yeah, you know, in the sector, we love new interventions. We've brought in new ways of supporting students. I can see it paying off. And I can see that, you know, I can see things that we're doing are paying off. They're really improving students' lives. We've brought in something recently, actually. And, you know, this is back to the issue of inclusion. We've brought in a new personal development plan, and that checks in with students at key points through their journey. And through that, we have literally identified hundreds of disabled students, for example, who hadn't told us before. They hadn't shared with us that they had a disability. Now, by doing that, by bringing in that new system, that means that we're speaking to them now, and maybe we can do things with those students that wouldn't have happened if we hadn't brought that that particular system in. And that will mean that they're more likely to be successful. They're going to finish that degree. They're going to have a fantastic career because of it. And so it is things like that, that, you know, that will mean that, you know, for all of us, we will all have that example, won't we? That brilliant example where we know that our university is doing something that tangibly has an impact, and it helps students come in, it empowers them. And I know it's a corny word, but it's that empowerment that we help to promote. That's the thing that gives me optimism. You know, that's the thing that gets me jumping out of bed, smiling every day.
It's lovely to see a smile on your face at the end of this interview, Deborah, and all the way through it. And for being, you know, thank you for all the work you do. Thank you for the commitment that you make to so many people to be that one, you know, to be a one person that we all need that believes in us, and to be doing work that's really helping transform so many lives at an institution that I've got a very soft spot for. Thank you for being our guest on HeadX today.
Thank you for having me, Martin.
Well, Paul, what did you make of the story of Deborah Johnston and of London South Bank University?
Fantastic. And I think Deborah's optimistic perspective at the end of her interview just there is the perfect segue. She ended on an optimistic note, her message of hope. And I believe her message of hope, to me, connects perfectly with the hope that universities provide for a better society. So universities, we have a positive impact on society. We are the machine that can lead us to a more inclusive society. And part of that is the impact we have on our students. And I loved, really thought it was powerful, where Deborah talked about LSBU focus on a social mobility index and how it measures the distance students go from coming in, where they came from, where they end up. And I know you've spoken a lot about that as yourself in other podcasts.
I'm fascinated by how universities position themselves and strategize for being distinctive. I think we have more need for more distinctiveness in our global universities. I think we have a particular need for that in Australia. And I fear sometimes that converting everything that a university does down to one number, which purports to measure all aspects of quality in an institution, is problematic from a number of points of view. I think it's problematic because there is no such number. The methodologies behind generating such numbers are arbitrary. But it also, I think, encourages counterproductive and you know, inappropriate behaviours. It encourages too many universities to all be the same and like each other, striving for a place in the rankings rather than accepting distinctiveness in mission and trying to prove themselves by what they believe in rather than what everyone else aims for. So I think it's a great initiative. So, Paul, it's perhaps worth acknowledging too at the conclusion of this episode that we're having this conversation shortly after you received your OAM, that Deb Terry received her AC award from our own New Year's Honours list. And we've had our guest on the show today in Deb Johnston with her MBE in the parallel UK National Honours list, also awarded at the start of this year. So a very prestigious episode today, and a lovely combination of perspectives of views from disability and inclusion, and looking ahead to a more equitable future for global higher education.